Welcome to this Forthright Radio for July 19th, 2017. I'm Joy LeClaire. We have a very full show for you today. With us for the full hour is William Hoagland. We'll be speaking with him about his latest book, The Autumn of the Black Snake, the creation of the U.S. Army and the invasion that opened the West, published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux in 2017. But first, since we're focusing on American history, today's date marks a couple of anniversaries I want to bring to your attention. On this date, July 19th in 1848, the Seneca Falls Convention was convened. It was the first women's right convention, eventually leading after more than seven decades to, among other things, the 19th Amendment, granting women's rights to vote in the United States. And on July 19th, 1692, eight people were found guilty of witchcraft and hanged in Salem, Massachusetts, including Reverend George Burroughs, the only minister to be executed. But now, we'll fast forward 100 years to more enlightened times, as the American Revolution had been won and the power elites of that era were looking west across the Appalachian Mountains to so-called vacant lands for speculation and expansion, with only one problem, that being the people who had been living there for millennia and didn't agree that it was vacant. Our guest, William Hoagland, has written about this era in three previous books, The Whiskey Rebellion, Declaration, and Founding Finance. His latest book, The Autumn of the Black Snake, The Creation of the U.S. Army and the Invasion that Opened the West, goes in depth into the history surrounding the American Revolution, and particularly a major defeat of the new United States. In fact, the greatest defeat affected by North American indigenous peoples in the history of this continent. But few have heard about it, much less the individuals who made it happen. Our guest, William Hoagland, is determined to remedy this. And with that as introduction, we welcome you, William Hoagland, to Forthright Radio.
Thanks very much. It's great to be here.
Well, it's really great to have you. In your prologue, you describe the French claims in North America and how different they were in perspective and aims from the British, and for that matter, from the Spanish. So let's begin there. Please tell us about it.
Well, the French had a long history in North America that, of course, because it's well before the formation of the United States, we don't necessarily see as all that decisive. Although, of course, there are many place names in the Midwest that have French origin. The French had a kind of an approach to what we call the West, which at the time would have meant, you know, anything west of the Appalachians from the British sort of English-speaking point of view. The French didn't really see that area as a West because their empire, their imperial ambition was a little different. You know, they had their big citadel at Quebec, and then, of course, we associate the French rightly with New Orleans. So we're talking about a kind of a sweep of influence and power that goes from what we think of as the North all the way down to what we think of as the South. And it's really the Mississippi Valley. And then, you know, as you going upward, it's like sort of through the Great Lakes and out the St. Lawrence to the sea that way, and then down the Mississippi all the way to New Orleans and Biloxi and out to the sea that way. A term I've used in the book that I borrowed from another scholar is intramarine. That's how they looked at their empire. Their ambition was really to develop the fur trade mainly, in competition with other empires.
You begin the book with a section, Sinclair's Retreat, and a chapter, The Death of General Butler. Tell us about that.
Long after the French, of course, had left, we're zooming ahead to 1791 now. We're talking about November of 1791, in which really a very important battle took place that doesn't really get named or discussed much, and it's the terrible defeat, from the U.S. point of view, of a force of American troops led by General Arthur Sinclair to the banks of the Upper Wabash in what is now northeastern Indiana. But it should also be seen as a thrilling victory for the Native Confederation that brought it about and defeated Sinclair there. It's quite decisive in that partly what happened is that while the U.S. had been sort of saying, well, there really is no Indian war going on, we just have to do a little mop-up of a few recalcitrant Indians, it was this massively, brilliantly executed military victory of Native forces over the United States. And in that victory, the Confederation of Indigenous Nations brought about what was really the most, overwhelmingly, the most decisive defeat of U.S. troops in all of the ensuing Indian wars that are much more famous later on, the whole 100-year sweep, really, that succeeded it. And yet we don't really know about it. I mean, basically, the entire past for a U.S. Army was almost entirely wiped out, and the U.S. had to start again from scratch. That's how big that victory was. It turned a big historical wheel in history, in world history, really, because it made the United States realize that if it was going to assert sovereignty in what was actually Indian country from the Indian point of view, the United States was going to have to develop a whole new strategy and a whole new kind of army. And that, of course, led to the formation of the United States as a military power.
Give us an idea of the numbers involved, please.
In terms of today's numbers, of course, it wouldn't sound so huge because this was a smallish force. Actual exact numbers of the dead and the casualties are hard to get. They range from, say, around 900 casualties. This is in the course of, you know, a couple of hours in the morning, to maybe 1,200, actually, is probably the most extreme. This would represent, you know, an overwhelming portion of the force that was there. And I should also add this kind of somewhat startling from today's point of view, this fact that this wasn't only soldiers. Of course, soldiers traveled with civilians, meaning suppliers and wagon drivers and contractors and so forth. But in those days, they often also traveled with their wives, with girlfriends, with children, and indeed with babies. And really, all of the women, I believe, except one, were killed in this battle, and most of the children. I think all the children. And so it was kind of a shock to the new nation. I mean, kind of one of these, you know, giant, politically and publicly noticeable horror moments for the new nation to have such a devastating defeat, when what had been said was, oh, you know, we're not going to get drawn into war here. We're just going to sort of mop up a few problems. And that was given the lie on that day in November.
And you write that from the perspective of the power elites in the East Coast, the Indians were referred to as banditti, and that this was like a strike force that was going to, as you say, clean them up.
Yeah, that's right. That word banditti, like bandits, you know, in plural or something. Like this, the idea that there's just the policy and sort of the narrative, the public narrative. And I think to a great extent, the elites in the United States believed this, too. They didn't want to see indigenous people as having the tactical and military superiority that they proved they had in 1791. They wanted to see Indian people as just sort of easily defeated as long as you bring enough troops and so forth, you can always defeat them. That was kind of the line. And there were also other political and policy reasons to just ignore the idea that this was actually a war. The United States felt that it was entitled to that territory based on the defeat of the British, who had then ceded that territory to the United States. So the idea that there was actually a major war that would have to be fought to conquer that territory sort of went against everything the United States elites wanted to believe. So they characterized what was actually quite a fearsome Native force. They characterized them as sort of banditti in the sense that they were renegade, you know, lone, small individual bands that just had to be kind of brought under the rubric of peace as dictated by the United States, and that it was going to be easy. It was just going to be a quick strike, sort of fear and awe, strike terror into the hearts of the Native people, and everything will be fine. And that's pretty much the opposite of what actually occurred.
We are going to get to the leaders of the Indians in a moment. But before we do that, I want us to back up to a little bit of prehistory of what we are talking about now. You reveal details of George Washington's life that I found pretty shocking. Please talk about George Washington, his situation from when he was a young man, and the Ohio Company, and also that you write that George Washington began his public career by starting the Seven-Year War, which is also known as the French and Indian War, and that it was the best thing for his career. So combine all those questions into one, please.
It is somewhat shocking now, and even that is sort of strange because a lot of these facts are really quite well known in the historical record. And yet when I bring them up and put sort of weave them into a narrative, they can be quite startling because they have to do with sort of the personal interest of George Washington in many of his, in the projects that he pursued throughout his career, beginning, as you say, when he was a young man. George Washington grew up in a world in which property and property ownership and development of property was crucially important to sort of the idea of manhood in the world that he came from. And he was actually, he came from some disadvantage in that way. And we often don't think of George Washington as coming necessarily from disadvantage because he became kind of the archetype of aristocratic Virginia in his day. But he was effectively disinherited in favor of his elder brothers and had to kind of make his own way. He didn't have great plantation holdings and so forth. And that was the way people in his world, you know, define themselves. The men in his world define themselves that way in terms of power and business. So he began to speculate financially in land because he and others of his time saw the future, and they saw that particularly tobacco planting, just depletes land. And so you always have to play out your land and keep moving on. So the whole idea of the West, which would then mean across the Blue Ridge Mountains and across the Alleghenies and looking at the headwaters of the Ohio River and then beyond, that was the American West at that time from their point of view. Well, that all looked very, very valuable. It's incredibly fertile. It had never been tapped. It hadn't been played out. So Washington worked his way up, really, and began to invest very, very cleverly and with great intensity in what was called Western land. And by a fairly early age, he had amassed some land wealth, you would call it. I mean, it was all kind of a speculation because you had to find a way to get it to pacify the Indians and the French who were there at that time when he was growing up, and then figure out a way to settle it. And how are you going to make your money on this became kind of a lifelong project for him. So in that context, yes, indeed, as you just mentioned, he working with the lieutenant governor of Virginia, the royal governor, who himself was very interested in personally exploiting Western land and using his position to mingle public and private benefit, Washington ended up kind of stumbling into starting what became, we call it the French and Indian War, because that's what it was sort of looked like to British English-speaking people here in America, but it was actually a global conflagration. The Seven Years' War, sometimes people call it sort of the first of the world wars, because it spread around the globe and involved, you know, a million casualties and movements of millions of people. Well, some say, and I think there's a good argument for it, that war started really right near the Ohio headwaters in what is now western Pennsylvania, and with George Washington kind of stumbling into a fight with the French. It was not an edifying moment in his career in any way. And yet he distinguished himself in the ensuing war and continued to rise up in Virginia society and in what was going to become one day national American society through that process. And by the time we get to, you know, fast forward to the Revolution, and then, of course, fast forward to his presidency, he became, from being this somewhat disadvantaged Virginian and real estate dealer, basically, a real estate speculator and developer, to being considered widely, you know, by other European powers and so forth, the greatest man in the world. It's quite a trajectory, but it does involve these kind of startling facts about him, which have to do with his absolute dedication to pursuing his own private interests and sort of identifying his private interests with the public interest, especially when it comes to settling what was then called the West. So this plays into his role as president in developing an army to actually take that land. He had both a personal and a public interest. And with George Washington, it's very hard, probably impossible, actually, to kind of distinguish the public and the private interests.
And you have said elsewhere that our current 45th president is by no means the first property developer, let's say, to be president and combine the public and private interests.
It's very interesting that way. I mean, I would say that George Washington is distinguished from our current president possibly by being a very successful real estate developer. But the fact that in those days, public figures mingled the public and the private interest, I guess the issue there is we've come a long way since then. There have been a lot of changes in kind of the ideas of what public ethics are supposed to involve. But we cannot look back to our founding in order to find, you know, perfect examples of what we today consider high ethical conduct regarding personal and private interest, because really the country was largely, I mean, and this is, the, I guess, one of the larger themes of Autumn of the Black Snake. I mean, one of the things that's particularly startling about it may be that in many ways the nation itself was founded in part to further the personal interests of certain American elites. And so that doesn't mean there was no public interest. I mean, they created a nation, and we are still to this day citizens of that nation they created. It's a complicated and sort of thorny story. But if we leave out the intense personal interest of many of our most famous founders, Washington probably the most important because he was the first president, but he was by no means alone in this. If we leave that out, I think we're missing a hugely important part of like of some of the bases of what made this country what it was to become.
I still want to get to Little Turtle and Blue Jacket, who were really the stars of the story in a way. But I was fascinated by what you had to say about Thomas Jefferson and his outlook on property rights, freehold versus tenure, direct ownership, going back to the Anglo-Saxons, and what a contradiction it was in taking lands that had been inhabited by the Indians. Could you go into that?
Yeah, Jefferson plays a fascinating role in sort of the background to this story. Going all the way back to the 1770s, he developed a theory of rights and liberty that was not really original with him, but he developed it specifically in relationship to American rights. And of course, we know about that because we know that he authored the original draft of the Declaration of Independence and so forth. But what I'm looking at here is how he, also a member of that planter aristocracy that Washington aspired to be a member of, developed a theory of landholding. He really believed that the monarch, the king, who supposedly, by British point of view, had tenure over all, had sovereignty over all of that American land. Jefferson developed the idea that actually a monarch cannot have an underlying claim on your land, that that is your land, that you hold it freely, and that that is a critically important right of Englishmen, as he might have put it, going back to the Anglo-Saxons, and that this whole idea of liberty that so one of the conclusions of that is that this whole idea of liberty that we now celebrate has some very tangled roots in some of Jefferson's thinking about being able to not just hold land, because for Jefferson, the pursuit of happiness really has to do with leaving where you happen to have been born and moving by choice to new lands. And if you find new lands, well, then you have an absolute right to hold them yourself, unencumbered by some sort of monarchical sovereignty, which many of his contemporaries in the planter aristocracy looking for lands west of the mountains interpreted to mean, well, you know, we can just take that land. We don't actually have to have royal permission to deal with the Indians. We can deal with the Indians ourselves, and we can buy it or inhabit it as we see fit. And really, the king, the crown, and parliament have no role here. And so much of our thinking about independence, really American independence, as it came out of some of those Virginia patriots, involves a rejection of the royal desire to regulate how Americans took land from Indians and create a kind of free-for-all mentality in which, really, if you find certain land and if you can find some way to sort of establish that it's now your land, not the land of the people who are already living there, well, then you have a right to do that. And that played very, I think, quite directly into the very Declaration of American Independence that precedes the story I'm telling.
So, well, there's a lot more to say about those two individuals and their cohort. The one thing I wanted to add about Thomas Jefferson, and this is referring to the great problems of using the same land over and over to grow tobacco. He is quoted as having said, "Better to move than manure." He was speaking, this was part of his concept of an agrarian society, just constantly moving west. Okay, so here are the new Americans moving west. They're doing it even before the revolution, but once the revolution has happened, they're really aiming at it. There are two individuals that you highlight, Little Turtle, who was a Miami, and Blue Jacket. Talk about them, please.
I'm very glad you said that they're stars of the show in a way, because I find often, and it's not the interviewers, it's often me too, it's often easier to talk about these more famous people, you know, Washington, Jefferson, and so forth. forth, as we have been doing, and because people are more familiar with them. People are much less familiar with Blue Jacket and Little Turtle for a number of reasons that in themselves are interesting. So it's very gratifying to me to hear you call them the stars of the show, and I think in many ways they are. This is a little-known confederation that had this absolutely gigantic world historical decisive effect, and I think its leaders, the confederation itself and its leaders, should be better known. Yes, as you've just said, Blue Jacket, the Shawnee leader, and Little Turtle, the Miami leader, what's one of the things that's fascinating about them is how very, very different their personalities were, and yet how, in a way, they for a long time, they were able to not only overcome that difference, but actually use that difference to create such a powerful native organization. Blue Jacket was characteristically sort of flamboyant. It's funny because he did not wear blue jackets, even though that was the name he was known by many. He wore scarlet jackets, often with epaulets. He was a big dresser. He had a big house. He had a lot of property. He was a businessman in the fur trade and very much a sort of an assertive and flamboyant person with a lot of swagger. In some ways, it's funny, as I was writing it, I found myself struck by comparisons between his rise in his society and George Washington's rise in his. And yet, of course, Blue Jacket, so much less known. He believed in sort of a throw them out kind of mentality. I mean, he wanted to really reclaim, make sure that land got claimed and preserved for Native people. And his attitude was pretty uncompromising. Little Turtle, the Miami leader, he was uncompromising, too. He definitely wanted to hold white incursion back behind the Ohio River, keep it to the east of the Ohio River. But he had a different sort of approach to, I don't know, I guess to sort of military life and to thinking about just human interaction. He sort of had a tragic, I think of it as a sort of a tragic sense or a philosophical sense, so that once he and Blue Jacket had this fantastic victory over Arthur Sinclair's forces, Blue Jacket's idea, the more sort of more obvious idea, really, that I think many of us would have, is like, wow, we're winning. You know, we're really kicking it here. We can't lose. Now we're going to really be able to do this. Little Turtle was very worried. That victory, instead of being a moment of great celebration for him, was really more a sign that, you know, uh-oh, now we're on top. And once you're on top, someone's going to come knock you down. He didn't really believe the United States was going to remain defeated. And so he was very, in certain ways, he had this philosophical sense, but in another way, he had this kind of pragmatic sense. He thought if the British, who were in forts in Canada, if they don't give us artillery, we're not going to succeed against the United States. They are going to come back. And in this moment of disagreement, their great collaboration, which had led to the greatest victory that indigenous forces would ever have, ever, against the United States, their partnership, their collaboration, began to kind of decline as they began to see things very differently. And so it's a fascinating relationship, in some ways a kind of a tragic relationship, because they couldn't really, in victory, they couldn't really stay together. But I think just in general, the whole way that they conducted themselves with one another and as leaders of a large, large movement, and they weren't the only leaders either, they're just the ones we know the most about, is very telling and very interesting, and really not just in Native American history, but in all of American history, I think they should be seen as crucially important.
William Hoagland, you write that kind of contemporary to this time and earlier, there was a rise of what you call fundamentalism among the Native people. Please talk about that.
Yes, and I think Blue Jacket, who I was just talking about, participated in that to some extent, although in a kind of a complicated way. During, you know, going back now to sort of the British Imperium when the French left in 1763, and the British began to become, you know, it was kind of began to monopolize, we could say, the European relationships with the Native people. Before the French left, there had been competition between the British and the French about the fur trade, and so deals had to be made and inducements had to be given to the Native trading partners. But once the French were out, the British sort of, at first, they tried this. It didn't work well. They created a kind of an austerity program because they felt there was no need to compete anymore. They were going to dictate terms. And for some time, even before that, there had been these movements, these kind of fundamentalist ascetic movements within Native societies to sort of reject the European influence. Because it's important for us to remember, I think it's hard to keep in mind, that at the time we're talking about, even if I'm talking about the 1760s, contact was a very, very old phenomenon. And there was no actual, by the time we're talking about, there was no way really to totally distinguish native culture and European culture. They had intertwined much more thoroughly than many, especially around, you know, in the east and in the western part of the country that we're talking about now. Of course, we're not talking about the plains. But in the part of the country we're talking about, there had been much, much intertwining of these cultures. And so native people depended on, you know, log homes and iron kettles and tailored clothing and so forth. But there were intermittent movements to reject all that and to purify things and to throw out white influence as an evil. And, of course, this became highly politicized once the British begin to really crack down. So you begin to get this sense where many native people begin to stop thinking of themselves solely as Shawnee or Miami or one branch of Shawnee or one branch of Miami or something like that, and begin to think about Indianness kind of as a pan-Indian mentality where we all have to get together to hold back off this white influence. So we all have to identify as Indians. Whereas, of course, mostly people had not identified as Indian, because even the name, of course, is a misnomer, and people identified the way people identify. They identified with their nation or with their branch or with their family and all of the above. There hadn't been this sort of sense of pan-Indianness. But as these things began to intensify, leading into the American Revolution, and then in the story I'm telling, out of the American Revolution, there became a much more unified ethnic sense that was sort of, in a funny way, fundamentalist, nativist, ascetic, and had to do with really rejecting all of what were considered sort of the pollutions, the spiritual pollutions of European society. So that plays into the story I'm telling in some interesting ways, especially around the character of Blue Jacket, who had all these contradictions. You know, he was very much a kind of like throw them out kind of guy. He really had bought into that idea that the West needed to be purified of any kind of a white settlement. At the same time, he's so interesting because he was very much a lover of all of the European habits and conveniences. I mean, he liked tailored clothing, and he liked to drink alcohol, and all of the things that the fundamentalist preachers were saying, you know, you've got to get rid of all these things, he took part in. So that makes him, again, just such a fascinatingly complicated character.
William Hoagland, you have wonderful maps in your book that are very helpful. We don't have that in radio. Could you please describe the areas we're talking about, and then the treaties? There were a series of treaties, and the history of treaties between the United States and Native people is not a particularly honorable one, and it starts pretty much right away. So first the geography, and then the treaties.
Yeah, the maps really are helpful. It's very difficult when we're just talking like this for people to visualize where we're talking about. So I'll give that a shot. I had a great map maker who really captured the feeling as well as the locations. The area we're talking about, where the action really is the whole area. Today, in modern terms, I'd say, you know, west of Pittsburgh, where the Ohio River begins, and then go all the way down the Ohio River, all the way to where it joins the Mississippi, and kind of north of that boundary, the Ohio River boundary, and then all the way out to the Mississippi, and then all the way up to the Great Lakes. So that's a massive territory, and had great value sort of imperially, and then had great value for the United States. And, of course, it had great value for the many, many indigenous nations that used it, lived in it, developed it, did all the things they did. So that's a big piece of country at the time. So that's the broad geography. So from the Appalachians, you know, down the Ohio River out to the Mississippi, and then sort of north and west of that slice all the way up to the Great Lakes. So we're talking about the modern Midwest plus parts of western Pennsylvania, I suppose, the whole thing, which later, of course, became the great, you know, sort of cradle of American industry, but at the time was very much fought over. So that's kind of the big map. The treaty lines are very interesting because it begins with the British, really, when they still had the imperium in North America. One of the things that I think people are surprised by to learn, who haven't studied this period, is that the British government was very concerned to keep American investors and American settlers from just randomly flowing west into Indian country and taking that land in an unorganized way. So that the British, while in no way sort of politically correct regarding Native American people or anything, but the British had a strong interest in maintaining the fur trade And settlement messes up the fur trade. You start cutting down trees where the indigenous partners don't want trees cut down. The hunting becomes more difficult. The Indians get pushed out. This does not promote fur trade. And the British were concerned to promote the fur trade, keep it going, keep the native, by the time their austerity thing had not worked, they were trying to keep the native people relatively happy and in positive relations with British, with English-speaking people. So the American attempt to just settle that land, invest in it, buy in it, the rejection of crown control over that was really a problem for the British government. And so in 1763, actually, upon the departure of the French, the crown drew a line on a map, basically, along the crest of the Appalachians, effectively. I would say it's more complicated than that, but that's the best way to think about it. The 1763 proclamation line, it was called, basically announcing that no white settlement was to occur west of that line, and any white settlement that was already there was going to be removed by the British Army. This was in the interest of preserving all that land west of the Appalachians for the native trading partners in the promotion of the fur trade and orderly process. This was a huge cause of resentment among many of the, of course, all the speculators in Western land, because they felt they had a lot of value there and that they needed to realize it, and they were seeing that value being wiped out. So we show that line in the book on one of the maps. It's a very important line because it was partly a cause of war, partly a cause of revolution for many of those Virginia patriots and other speculators in Western land. And then you can see the lines, as happened later in the plains and so forth. And we know about that, but it starts early. You can see those lines starting to shift westward, so that there's an agreement in 1763 made by the British that we're not going to go across the Appalachians. And then even when the British were still there, the pressure was too great. It was too hard to enforce that line. So an agreement was made by entreaty to move that line to the headwaters of the Ohio River, which is a big push westward for white interest. So that was a concession that the British made sort of to the impossibility of patrolling the line they had drawn at the Appalachians. But you can already see what's happening. And certainly the native people living there could see in a very gritty way what was happening. Every time you draw a line, then it exists for a while, supposedly, and then there's pressure to keep moving it further and further into Indian country, pushing the Indians into further, smaller and smaller places. So that you can see that on some of the maps in the book. And of course, this is what the fight was for that I'm writing about. The war that I'm writing about was to, the Indians were saying, no, we have an agreement to keep that line at the headwaters of the Ohio River. You can't come north and west of the Ohio River. That was an agreement. And the war was to void that agreement. The war I'm writing about in Autumn of the Black Snake was to void that agreement and take over that whole area and then reserve, as the term was, a spot for the Indians to move to. Hence, we begin at that point seeing the lines for what would become the ensuing reservations. The whole treaty period really begins with the story I'm telling. And we know more about what happens later. We know that those treaty lines were violated by the U.S., and of course we know about the removal of Indians to Oklahoma and so forth. What we tend not to know, I think, is that whole question of drawing the lines, violating the lines, moving the lines westward and so forth, really begins in the founding generation. And that's part of what I'm trying to bring out in the story and with those maps that you mentioned, yeah.
There is a clause in the Declaration of Independence that I'll quote. He, referring to George III, has excited domestic insurrections amongst us and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages, whose known rule of warfare is an indistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. So that was one of the clauses and causes of the American Revolution. In an effort to get more information out in the time that we have, in 1786, there was the biggest conference since the Sandusky meeting, which you were referring to. Many nations convened at Fort Detroit in collaboration with the British troops still holding that fort. Can you please talk about that? That was 1786.
Some students of the period, people who've read up on this, know that the British did not evacuate the forts they were holding on U.S. soil. It became U.S. soil per their agreement with the U.S. in 1783, but some of the critical forts along the lakes they held anyway. That it took some time to get those evacuated. Fort Detroit was one of the most, was probably the most strategic. The two big ones were Fort Niagara to the east and Fort Detroit to the west. Of course, that is where Detroit is today. But it had been a French fort, and now it was a British fort, and now it was technically American, but the British weren't leaving yet. There were a number of negotiations that had to occur to make that happen. While they were still there, they were very interested in trying to push back against some of the land cessions that had been given in the Treaty of 1783 that made America independent. One of their ways of dealing with that was to ally themselves with the native people that we're talking about, with Little Turtle and Blue Jacket and the Confederation that was trying to hold that land for Indians north and west of the River Ohio. The British officials, the British Army and the British officials at Detroit, played a very important role in trying to help organize native resistance to American encroachment. And this was a very tense period. I mean, a superficial reading of the period is that, you know, America became independent, the British went away, and then the War of 1812 happens, and finally then it gets mopped up. But actually, that whole period was tremendously tense between America and England because of this presence, especially in the West. And the when Little Turtle wanted artillery, he said, "We're not going to win again if we don't get artillery." He meant he wanted the British to give them artillery, and he went to the fort, actually, and asked for artillery. But the British were doing this, I mean, that conference you've referred to in 1786, this kind of helping to organize the resistance of the Indians to U.S. encroachment was one thing. And they did do that, and they helped them hold conferences, and they offered to serve as mediators. The strategy would be to sort of mediate, meaning they would actually create a big buffer zone there with British protection for the Indians, which in a sense would get them, some British officials felt would get them some land back in the West. So they did a lot of organizing, and that conference was one of the key moments, actually, of helping to organize the resistance and sort of advise the Indians. But they always played a kind of double game because they were afraid, they wanted to fight a proxy war with America, but they wanted it to remain proxy. They didn't want to be sort of caught out actually sending troops into the field, artillery into the field, British artillery, which would be very identifiable. So there was a very tense set of relations among the U.S., the Indians, and the British who were in Detroit and Niagara at that time.
Let's get to the creation of the U.S. Army. Meanwhile, back east, we've had the Constitutional Convention. That was a whole epic story in its own right that we don't have time to go into. But there were tensions around the nationalists and the anti-nationalists, those who wanted to create a standing army and those who said, no, we'll never have a standing army. That's the road to fascism and tyranny. They didn't say fascism back then. Talk about some of these tensions and what was involved in the ultimate creation of a standing army.
George Washington had always wanted a professional, nationally run or top-down run army. Even when he was fighting in the Revolution, there was a strong feeling among many Americans of the day that militia, state-oriented militia, was the only way to have a military force that wouldn't tend toward tyranny. They thought of the British Army, for example, as a classic example of the standing army in which there's a permanent army even in peacetime, and it's people's professions, sort of the dregs of society, as Americans saw it, were hired to do the king's bidding. There was no independence. And so there was a strong feeling that militia were the appropriate way to run an army for free people. Washington definitely disagreed with that, having actually tried to run an army based on, you know, very limited top-down control throughout the Revolution, where many Americans thought the militia had won the American Revolution. Washington thought the militia had come close to losing the American Revolution, the War of Independence, and he always wanted a much more regular, much more professional, much more uniform army. However, he faced all this political opposition to doing that, even as president. Many of the fights that had gone into the Constitutional Convention about state sovereignty, where sovereignty lies, is it with the nation or with the states, devolved on this question of who can field an army, because that's one of the hallmarks of sovereignty. And of course, the states were no longer in a position to really field an army, although they did retain their militias. You know, Congress was afraid to do anything very unpopular, and was afraid that forming a standing army would be unpopular, and the Constitution gives Congress the power to form a regular army, but Congress, as we've learned lately, you know, the Constitution's not self-executing. It doesn't do anything much but give people powers that they can either use or ignore, and Congress just declined to use its power to form a regular army, despite Washington's deep desire to have one, and Hamilton's as well. Hamilton was another big author of that that desire to have a professional army. I mean, nation states have professional, nationally run uniform armies. That's how they looked at it. If we're going to be a viable nation state, we're going to need that. In order to get that, well, one thing it took to get that was the defeat of Sinclair that we've just been talking about. Washington needed it. It actually, while it was a horrible, horrible defeat for the United States, it served a purpose for those in Washington's cabinet, especially Knox, Henry Knox, Alexander Hamilton, and Washington, to put Congress in a position where it would be politically very inexpedient now to refuse to do what they'd been asking for already, which was form a more professional army. So that the politics of that, which we don't have time to go into any detail of, but I do kind of detail in the book, because just from a politics junkie point of view about how bills get passed and the kind of deals that get made and the kind of back channel ways people operate and the hardball politics involved are sort of fascinating to see occurring right there in the founding generation.
Yeah, so it's not a new thing. Let me interrupt you in the interest of time. The Autumn of the Black Snake. Who is the Black Snake?
The Black Snake is General Wayne, Anthony Wayne, otherwise known as Mad Anthony, and to his indigenous enemy, often referred to as the Black Snake, in grudging admiration, actually. It sounds like it might be insulting, but it's actually, they believed he was so disciplined. I mean, Little Turtle and Blue Jacket and others came to the conclusion that General Wayne was so incredibly disciplined that it was impossible to surprise attack him, as they had Sinclair. You couldn't steal supply, you couldn't steal horses. So they said he never sleeps, and they meant it metaphorically, like he actually has, he always has patrols out. He's so good at that. And they believed that the Black Snake, the animal, the Black Snake, was an animal that didn't sleep. So they called him the Black Snake, saying, you know, as Little Turtle said, you know, this guy, actually, if we don't get artillery, he's so good that we're going to be in trouble. He's not just another Sinclair. So that's Anthony Wayne, and he's really the first effective, you know, United States general. I mean, he actually, you know, to jump ahead and kill suspense here, he actually does succeed in conquering that territory at the Battle of Fallen Timbers, and did defeat Little Turtle and Blue Jacket and that amazing confederation of native people. And it was his amazing ability to build an army from scratch, an American army, a U.S. army for the first time, and then create enough discipline and enough tactics and enough strategy to get it to stop doing the things the army had been doing before, like throwing down guns and running away, actually stand and hold a line. He achieved that. And again, like Little Turtle and Blue Jacket, Wayne is not remembered today the way I think he should be, as this sort of decisively important American general, because he really won the first battle the United States ever won as a nation, and from that, and built the army that did that. And from that, so much world historically has followed.
And it's interesting, I think it wasn't intended in choosing that as the title, but in the struggles of indigenous people today, they refer to pipelines as the Black Snake. And it is, again, back down to land rights, sovereignty, treaties. It just hasn't ended. We like to think that history is history, but it's not. It's ever present.
It was not intended, that reference in the title, to the pipeline. In fact, I didn't know about that until I was partway through writing the book. And even I think, you know, I decided what the title was long before I knew the reference to the pipeline. But it did strike me the same way it's striking you. It really struck me when I realized that there was that connection. And yeah, as you say, history in that way is not history. It's ongoing.
General Wayne Anthony, I mean, excuse me, Anthony Wayne, I keep doing that. He was up against not only very savvy indigenous resistance, but subterfuge in his underlings. Talk about that a bit, please.
Wayne's second in command in this army that he was building from scratch against great odds was one James Wilkinson, who's really, he's one of the more fascinating characters in a book full of fascinating people. He was second in command in the new U.S. Army under Wayne at the same time that he was also a paid spy of Spain, and had been a paid spy of Spain for a long time. He lived a really double life, at least double, maybe triple, maybe quadruple. He was really this bizarrely appealing, and people really liked James Wilkinson. Some of the younger officers liked Wilkinson much more than they liked Wayne. Wayne could be irascible and gruff and impatient. Wilkinson was charming and friendly and nice to people. He was a very attractive personality, and yet nobody knew, actually, no one proved it until years after he died, that the whole time he was working for a foreign power. And it's really one of the strangest aspects of the story, I think. And Wilkinson, along with working for a foreign power, also really resented not having been made commander of the army himself. And so he hated Wayne, and they had known each other since the Revolutionary days when they were both quite young officers and had been friends. And were friends as far as Wayne was concerned. He didn't get what Wilkinson was doing. He didn't not only that Wilkinson was a Spanish spy, he didn't get that, but he also didn't get that Wilkinson spent all his time in the army trying to undermine Wayne's credibility with the junior officer class, also writing letters, anonymous letters to newspapers and having them published saying that Wayne was a drunk and an incompetent, writing under his own name back to Henry Knox, who was Secretary at War, saying that Wayne was the most incompetent general in the history of generalship and, you know, all of generalship. Just spent all of his time trying to undermine Wayne's efforts, and it didn't work, but it is just one of the strangest sort of themes of this early American attempt to be a nation, to form nationhood, and to be a military power, is this weird role of James Wilkinson, an inveterately duplicitous person. I don't get into this in the book. I don't think I get into it at all, actually. But in later times, he connected with Aaron Burr during Burr's expedition into Mexico. And then he sold Burr out, too, later. And the reason Burr was later prosecuted for treason was that James Wilkinson had been a turncoat against Burr. And he just was a professional traitor, basically. And he was the second in command during this entire war that I'm talking about, and including the Battle of Fallen Timbers. So that's a strange wrinkle in the story.
And in the pay of Spain, he was actually trying to undermine the success of the Americans at the British. Am I right?
Yes, although it's hard to read Wilkinson in the actual against the British. I think he was somewhat sincerely against the Indians and the British, partly just because for his own reasons. He wanted victories, and he wanted to be seen as a great leader himself, and he wished he was in Wayne's position. I don't think his connection with Spain made him pro-British, in fact, probably the opposite. But he was trying to undermine the size of the army. He allied himself with the anti-army contingent in Congress at the same time that he was also working for Spain. So he wanted to weaken the American army. And he was working kind of within the American army to weaken it for the benefit of Spain. In some ways, it seems largely for his own perceived benefit to himself. I think in the end, what his goal was sort of to take Kentucky and other parts of the southern part of the Midwest or the northern South away from the U.S. and make sort of his own private empire kind of allied to Spain. And while that seems completely mad today, it's true that things were so much in flux in those days that kind of thing was not fundamentally impossible. That's the crazy thing. I mean, it seems to us sort of so over the top that it could never have happened, but it wasn't clear to anybody at the time what could and couldn't happen regarding that country between the British and the forts in Canada, the Spanish potentially pressing from across the Mississippi, and of course all these Indian nations who were trying to defend their home. So, yeah, Wilkinson really is kind of a lightning rod for all of the tensions, and just in a kind of almost surreal way, he kind of embodies them.
There was also apparently an assassination attempt against General Anthony Wayne. A tree was cut that almost killed him. It landed on his legs instead of his abdomen. He was severely wounded, but he went on riding in his horse and also was suffering from gout to lead his men at the Battle of Fallen Timbers. And, you know, that was a great victory that led to the standing army being increased and increased. We are out of time. I've got 30 seconds for you to give us some closing statements.
I'll try to do that. I just, what I find amazing about this story is partly just that, you know, it's not just that no one else, many other people don't know it. It was known to historical scholarship before I ever got here, and yet it's not part of our public discussion. And what remains stunning to me is that we don't as citizens tend to know this story. And it's just, I think it's of overwhelming importance as in how we became fundamentally a nation state, and with all of its upsides and downsides. So that's kind of where I am at with this tale.
William Hoagland, your series of books about this era are really illuminating. Thank you so much for joining us today on Forthright Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great.
Our guest today on Forthright Radio has been William Hoagland. We have been discussing his latest book, The Autumn of the Black Snake, The Creation of the U.S. Army and the Invasion that Opened the West, published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux in 2017. Forthright Radio is a Beyond the Deep End production broadcast each first and third Wednesday of the month from the Philo Studios of KZYXNZ, Mendocino County Public Broadcasting. Engineer Rich Culbertson. I'm Joy LeClaire. You can contact us by emailing forthrightradio@gmail.com. And of course, the views and opinions expressed on Forthright Radio are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of KZYXNZ staff, its members, board of directors, or contributors.